Welcome to the Fabric Podcast. These messages are intended to spark your own reflections and conversations all week and beyond. That's why you can find it anytime along with other resources and ways to keep the conversation going at fabricmpls.com/scraps.
Hey, good morning, Fabric. It's great to see you all here on this cold and frosty morning. I'm Greg Meyer, and welcome to anybody listening on the podcast as well. We're glad that you're there with us virtually, somewhere, wherever you are. This postcard, we sent this out quite a few years ago as a way of like advertising ourselves, right? We're not a very good church. If you flip it over, it says, if your image of church is like most people's, we're glad we're not a very good example of it. I mean, that's kind of the idea behind it, and it's sort of what we're talking about these days. We're not interested in being a very good church. If by church you mean those buildings that sit on street corners that are part of denominations that separate themselves from other denominations, you know, by what they believe or their practices or traditions and all that sort of stuff, I mean, that's a game we don't really want to play. And if that's what church is, we're not really interested. We are interested in something else, though, maybe a different way of being church, and that's a little bit what we'll be talking about as well. So welcome to week three of Not One Stone. An important conversation for us to be having. It's all about starting over with God, faith, and church. And frankly, this is something that Fabric has been about since we decided. In fact, it was one of the reasons we decided to begin the process of creating a different kind of community, a community that does things in a different way. And it is also something that every one of us is about. Now, you're about it, or you need to be about it, not so that you can save the church, okay? Because that's actually not what matters. But because being church, that is finding a way to fully weave yourself with your true self and with others, including the whole world and with this, that which we call God, to be very vague about it, that matters. That's sort of what life is about. And to find a way of being able to do that meaningfully and not get stuck doing it, that is a little bit about what it's all about. So, you know, as I said the other week, if this is just my agenda or our agenda, then you can ignore it, right? Because, you know, we're just a bunch of malcontents. We don't like the way the church does things. You know, we've got different set of preferences and things like that. So we think, you know, we could do it better. If that's what this is all about, if that's what these questions are about, then that's fine. You're welcome to be a part of it, or you're welcome to push it off to the side. On the other hand, if this was Jesus' orientation to the whole idea of what church has become from the very beginning, in fact, if this is the general orientation that the Bible has had on us trying to, wrap our arms around that which God tries to bring us, then maybe it's something to pay attention to, right? Maybe it's something that can't be ignored. And, you know, that's sort of the situation. In fact, it's exactly the situation that we have. So this title, Not One Stone, comes from a story in Jesus' life, if you haven't been here up till this week, when Jesus was in Jerusalem with his disciples, and they're walking through the city, and one of his followers is looking at all these great big beautiful buildings that are created by the religion of their day, by Judaism, and says how fantastic they are, and Jesus' comment to it is, yeah, see all these big buildings? Not one stone will remain upon another. They will all be thrown down. Now, you can go back to the podcast of the first week and kind of hear more about that, but let me just cut to the chase and point out that he was not talking about buildings, all right, physical structures. He was talking about building, that is, this process of taking that which is truly valuable, truly precious, something of our hearts, and then trying to form something physical around it, something to make it preserved and to keep going and to make it permanent. To the people of his day, he was talking about the religion that they had built that they meant to contain, to capture, to hold on to manage and to control this experience that they had with God so they could pass it on to other people. To us today, what he's saying is, you've got the same tendencies, right? You take those things of your heart that are so valuable, so precious, and then you find ways to try to make it last, to guarantee it, to codify it, to do all those things, and you manage it and control it and preserve it in a way that takes all the life and the power out of the experience for you. And to all those tendencies, Jesus says, nope, nope, Not one stone. Not one stone will remain upon another. Don't build any walls around it. It will not bring you to it. It will only separate you from it. Now, it's kind of important to notice, like, the things he didn't say. Maybe the things that you would have expected him to say. Yeah, look at all those large and beautiful buildings. Nice, but we need to do some major redecorating, all right? I mean, the color scheme's all wrong. He didn't say that. He also didn't say, yeah, look at all these big buildings. We are going to build bigger, better, and more amazing buildings than these. No, what did he say? He said, not one stone. Not one stone will be left upon another. Yet we do it. I mean, we all do it, don't we? We have built a version of the church for centuries and centuries, and we still do it today. That is so much institution, so much a thing of our own making, that the life that sparked it in the first place is practically undetectable inside it. I mean, it's almost like you can't hear the heartbeat inside there because the walls are so thick. And that's a problem. And that is what Not One Stone is all about. It's about us building systems of belief and codes of behavior about institutions, denominations, buildings that overshadow and take place of that which gave it birth. And this week, though, I want to focus less on what we've done as a society, you know, about the church, about the big institution, and more about what we do as individuals to do this in our own lives, and then we bring it to what church could be. So, and this is on your outlines, just as a collective church is reduced to a human creation by society, so being church personally, your being church personally is reduced to your own individual preferences, your abilities, and your imaginations. And as wonderful as your preferences and your abilities and your imaginations are, they are not good enough to hold that which has called us together, that which beats in our hearts too, that which we have sensed and know is there waiting for us. Now, like I said, this isn't just our idea. In fact, it wasn't just Jesus' idea from, you know, that story we get there. This is really just built in, baked in to the whole message of the Bible from the very beginning all the way through. So I want to walk you through a story from the Bible that not only makes this point, but I think kind of gives us some direction. It kind of helps us understand what would be the posture we would have to have that kind of a relationship and to, you know, be a church instead of build a church. And this story comes from the primordial, shadowy memories of ancient Israel, right? From thousands of years ago. It's a story about Jacob at the River Jabbok. It comes from the first book of the Bible, Genesis. It's in Genesis 32. And I don't know if you know this story or not, but my guess is you probably never heard it this way before. So let me set the stage for you a little bit. So Jacob, one of the early characters in the Bible, a very long, complicated history. It's worth just kind of digging into it. It's actually kind of fun to dig into his stories. The whole second half of the book of Genesis is basically his story. And so Jacob left home because he had a big fight with his twin brother Esau and was afraid. And he becomes, you know, grows up to be an adult and pretty wealthy. And now it's time to come home. So he's brought his whole family and entourage back, and he gets as far as the River Jabbok, and when he crosses there, then he's in his homeland, and he knows Esau's on the other side, and he knows that Esau has lots of reasons not to welcome him home, okay? Put it mildly. So he does the manly thing. He sends his wife and kids first. And his entourage sets him across, you know, kind of soften up Esau, a bunch of gifts and things like that, and then he figures, I'll just spend the night back here, and then after kind of, you know, they've had a good time, I'll come over the next morning. So that's where our story picks up here. I'll read it Greg style, which means lots of commentary. Yeah, you laugh. So Jacob was left alone, and a man, Hebrew, ish, you could translate man, sort of a self, it's kind of, what was it, all right? But a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Nobody wrestles that long. I mean, what's a wrestling match? 3-4 minutes long? I mean, an hour maybe? All night long? Can't happen. What you know is, like, this is a real wrestling match. It also lets you know, maybe it's more than just a story, because that can't really happen. So what is it? What was this wrestling match, right? So he wrestled with him until daybreak. When the man, Ish, saw that he did not prevail, kind of a stilted word, huh? He didn't win. He didn't beat Jacob. He struck him on the hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint. That's a serious injury in a wrestling match, right? And then the man said, "Let me go, for the day is breaking." Okay, so what's that about? Kind of these primordial ideas of spirits don't want to be caught in the daylight. This is all getting kind of fuzzy and kind of strange here. "Let me go, for the day is breaking." But Jacob says, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And so he said to him, to Jacob, "What is your name?" Now that's a curious way to start a blessing. What is your name? He says, "Jacob." This is where the blessing is. Then the man said, the Ish said, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven, you have wrestled with God and with humans, and you have prevailed." Totally clear. You're not Jacob anymore. You're now going to be known as Israel. That's where Israel got its name. Why? Because you wrestled with God and you won, right? Seems clear. Well, believe me, it isn't. It is brimming with meaning when you start digging into this text. Then Jacob asked him, "Please tell me your name." Why? Yeah, there's an idea in ancient society. When I lived in Papua New Guinea, they had the same idea too. When you know the name of someone, you have some control over them. If I know the name of a spirit, I can call in that spirit and I can control that spirit. All right, so what is your name? And the spirit says back to him, the Ish says back to him, "Why is it that you ask my name?" What, you want to control me? Why are you asking my name? And there he blessed him. Blessed you. So he got the blessing, but what was it? Was it the whole thing? He got his name. Was that the blessing? Did the man something else and give him some kind of blessing? Or was the spirit, the whatever it was he was wrestling with, not telling his name to Jacob the blessing because Jacob was never supposed to be in control? He was saving him from that. So the story goes on, and he blessed him. So Jacob called the place Peniel, which literally means face of God, saying, "For I have seen God face to face." Aha, we found out. It wasn't a man. It wasn't a spirit. It was God. It was I am who I am. It was Yahweh he was wrestling with all night long. "And yet my life is preserved. I saw God face to face, and yet my life is preserved." Now, preserved is a very, very generous translation of that word in Hebrew. It really means like by the skin of your teeth. He escaped with his life is what it was. Like he eked out of it. He wasn't just preserved. Like he got away with something. And then the new day. "The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel, limping because of his hip." Now, you're probably saying, that was interesting. What was it about? Well, spend some time with it this week. It's, if you do these weekly readings, this is it. Bring your reflections you may have, questions you may have from the story to your group. I think that can be good. But the thing is, there is so much going on here that you can spend years on this story and only begin to start finding all the ways that this story is exploring. It isn't an answer story, but it's exploring very concretely this three-stranded life that we talk about here. This relationship with oneself and with others and with God, this piece that we got, the God that is as mysterious as the God was that Jacob was wrestling with that night. And it's interesting to note that the reason that this story was preserved over thousands of years, who knows how many thousands year old this story is not because it was so exciting. Yeah, it's a good story, but, it's not Toy Story. It's not Tolstoy. It's a good story, but it's not that great of a story. And it didn't stay in the Bible, didn't stay in these stories that they collected and passed on from generation to generation because it was a foundation of the Jewish religion that would grow up. No, in fact, it kind of undoes the Jewish religion. It stuck there for a very obvious reason, at least it seems to me, and that is it kept hinting at something. It was whispering at something that these people knew they needed to be reminded of if they were going to actually be able to have a relationship with this man, spirit, God, with Yahweh, with God. And maybe they had this sense that a story was going to be able to carry this important message on to next generations better than a religion could, than a building could, or than a doctrine that was created because of what they thought this story told. So, some questions that arise out of this story, which I'm not going to answer. So Jacob wrestling at the river Jabbok with a man, with a spirit, with a god, which was it? How did it start one way and another? What's that all mean? Go at it, okay? Another question, what does it mean to wrestle all night long until daybreak? How does one do that? And what is it talking about? But the big question, the one that I want to spend some time with right now, because this is where we want to go, this is, I think, what we're looking at, is this question, two words, who won? Who won the wrestling match? Jacob, right? I mean, it says Jacob prevailed, right? And that the spirit couldn't get away from him, right? You have striven, you have wrestled with God and people and prevailed. Yes, that's what it says, but who got what they came for from the wrestling match? And who walked away limping? It seems to be a little bit contradictory there, that each, this Hebrew, this man, spirit, God, got what it came for. I mean, you get a real clear sense that it came to wrestle with Jacob in order to let him know who he was to be and what his role was to be in the world to come. And it also, it is a spirit that gave up nothing, that walked away without an injury. Jacob walked away limping. The story wants us to rethink winning. The story wants us to rethink winning, at least in regard to our wrestlings with God, right? With our wrestlings with God. Let's just look at Jacob's win. If he was the winner here, right? One, he barely escapes with his life. It says, you know, he was preserved. His life was preserved. I mean, he got away by the skin of his teeth with his life. The Ish, on the other hand, can't get away, but inflicts this devastating wound, this dislocated hip to Jacob. The Ish doesn't give its name to Jacob, you know, refuses to answer the question, but Jacob has to give his name over to it. The Ish does seem to accomplish what it showed up for, like I said, in order to give Jacob his new name, to give him this inheritance. And then that spirit, too, eventually does give Jacob a blessing. Yes, but the blessing appears to be a name. I don't know. I mean, I didn't know Jacob. I was really young back in those days. My guess is, though, that Jacob had something a little bit more tangible in mind, like what he wanted to get from that spirit. He thought he was going to really get something that gave him some power. He got a name, you know? Like, what good is that? So, you wrestle with God. You have these battlegrounds. You've got all kinds of them, I would guess. But you wrestle with your purpose. You wrestle with the meaning in your life. You wrestle with seeking satisfaction, accomplishment, fulfillment, seeking hope. Now, I don't know what those wrestlings look like for you. You can add your own words, your own experiences to that list, what it is that you are wrestling with and for. And my guess is that when you have these wrestling matches, you very seldom end up walking away with what you wanted. But you have probably discovered by this point in your life that if you wrestle all night long, you do walk away with a new understanding of yourself. And you walk away with some sort of wounding, something that sets you back and makes you realize who you are, makes that identity a little bit more important, more real for you. You discover some limits. I can't do that. I'll never be able to do that. I never could do that. You also discover some connectedness. Like, I would like to be free to be able to do all these things, but I have these relationships. I have this meaning, things that make me stay who I am and where I am and not just exercise anything and everything that I would like and that I would want. The question would be, is that winning? Is that winning? Is it possible that winning this fight feels a lot like losing? The story says that it is so. It's one of these counterintuitive but makes sense things with what we learn about life. Winning is receiving your identity, your name, and your mortality, your limp. Winning is receiving your identity and your mortality and holding them in your hands and going forward with them. Without these two things, you are cut off from what really matters both within you and beyond you. You will never know them. You will never have them. Now, can I take you down a little Hebrew rabbit hole? That's a rhetorical question. I'm going to do it, no matter what you say. But I want to do it because that sentence in Hebrew in which Jacob gets his new name has some really important clues for us. And it's a good example, too, of, you know, when we just, you just try to read the Bible and say, well, this is what it tells me to do, is, yeah, be careful. Look more deeply. You might have to do some learning, check some footnotes, talk to other people, and start seeing what's really going on there, because the Bible's a little bit more sophisticated than what we read when we do it at a surface level like that. So so this line where Jacob gets his blessing, the man says to him, "You shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans, and you have prevailed." Now, in that sentence, which is up there, there are two nouns, two important nouns, the names, right? Jacob and Israel. And then there are two important verbs. They're also in bold on there. There's striving or wrestling, and there is prevailing and winning. Now, the connection between them seems good. It seems pretty obvious that Jacob is lined up with his old identity, right? That's the old name, lined up with the striving and wrestling. Israel, the new name, is linked up with prevail and to win, right? So Jacob went from striving to becoming Israel, the winner. But guess what? That's backwards. Because the name Jacob comes from the same root word as prevail or win, and the name Israel comes from the same root word as the word to strive or to wrestle. Jacob spent his whole life to this point being the winner, beating people out of things, getting stuff that wasn't necessarily his. He won and he won and he won and he became wealthy. And then he wrestled all night long and walked away wounded. And he was now a wrestler in a wrestling match that would never end. Now, you may need to process that for a minute, but that's what's going on. Jacob is converted from a winner to being a wrestler, a changed and a wounded wrestler. And rather than walking away from this with his fist pumping, he walked away with a limp. Wrestle with God until you lose. Wrestle with God until you lose. You were born to lose. You were born to wrestle with God over and over and to lose over and over. And when you wrestle that long and you lose that badly, guess what? You just won. Because that's what it was about. That's what it was about. So the Bible tries to give us this format. From the very, very beginning, so in the book of Genesis, the very first chapter, which tells, it's a, you know, one of the two creation stories, Genesis 1, Genesis chapter 2, not meant to give us any scientific understanding of how it happened, not a history lesson of how it happened, but just trying to depict poetically what our relationship is with all things around us and with ourselves and with God. And in that very first chapter, you have this line where God is reflecting over the possibility of making us, making humankind, and it says, "Let us make humankind in our own image, according to our likeness." Let us make humankind in our image. Now, the point is, I mean, you can spend some time thinking, well, what does that mean? Does that mean we look like God? Hopefully not for God's sake, but you know, or is there something outward about us that's like God, that looks like, think about that. I mean, that's obviously not what it means, but exploring that's worthwhile. But that's not what I want to look at. What I want to look at is the relationship between creating and being made. Like, who is in the image of whom? That's an important part of this story. And it's really clear that we are made in God's image, not God made in ours. So this tendency to make God and faith and church in our own image, that's the Achilles heel of religion. It stops wrestling and it focuses on winning. Rather than being made in God's image, it tries to continually make God in its image, a God that it can handle, that it can control, that it can understand, that it can pass on to other people, all right? And very, very seldom is it done with evil intent or anything like that. It's just what happens. It's just what we do. We hold on to this name prevailing when our inheritance is to be striving. We build ourselves up. We build up this thing that we call religion, one stone at a time, to be strong and to be enduring and to resist the wound that we have. And we here at Fabric are no more immune from that tendency, human tendency, than any other community that tries to get together and to embody what this experience with God and one another and ourselves is all about. The best we can do is be aware of it and to choose to be defeated sometimes as often as we can. So to be faithful to this purpose, religion has to continually let itself be defeated so that it can win, right? And that is very, very hard for us to do. Now, again, I don't want to be, this. I'm not talking about this to point my finger at religion, all right? Not point my finger at other churches or institutions and denominations who I've done it wrong. I'm talking about it so we can understand what we are doing and how we are trying to live in relationship to each other and how we are trying to be a community, all right? Because there's nothing that any of us like to do more than create God, whatever that represents for us, in our own image. I mean, what we do is like, I'm going to shop around. I'm going to do kind of the buffet line creation of God. I'm going to go through with my plate and, you know, I'd like a little of this, like a little of that. You know, what is the God that fits my preferences, the God that I'm comfortable with, the God that shares most of my opinions, is on the same side of the issues as I am? And I've often quoted Anne Lamott's phrase, "You can always tell you've created God in your own image if your God hates all the same people you do." You know? Bingo. Yeah. This is a very handy God to have, this God that you have created in your own image. It's also a very dangerous God to have. It is not one that will help you lift yourself beyond who you can be and what your aspirations are all about. And to fulfill yourself, it's one that is going to just get you stuck. So, lesson number one, resist the temptation to create God in your own image, right? Resist the temptation to make God in your own image. We also do it to our relationships. Now, you're probably all much better people than me, and I'm sure you don't do this, so I'll just talk about my tendency, is that I have a tendency to want the people around me, family, friends, coworkers, to be more like me. And when they are, I consider it a great improvement. I have ways of rewarding people for behaving in ways that are familiar, that are convenient, that are comfortable for me. I know you guys don't do this, but just, you know, bear with some of us simple humans. And then I also have ways of disincentivizing, we'll call it that, people for doing what's unfamiliar, inconvenient, or uncomfortable for me. Yeah. We also do it to the earth around us, right? The entire climate crisis is a result of people trying to make the world in our own image. We want its systems, we want its habitats, we want its resources to reflect what we want from it. We want to live this way, so we want the world to deliver it to us, ignoring the fact that it's not our job to create, decide what the image of the world should be. It's our job to live in relationship to it and to go through that wrestling match and discover who are we in the context of this world and the way that it is. Lesson number two, resist the temptation to make people and the world in your own image. My guess is I'm not the only one who does it. There's probably a couple of us here. So that brings us to the end, to the limp, to the wound. The result of a wrestling match that we win by sticking with it until we get some sense knocked into us. What was it in your life, what was it in your experiences that told you in no uncertain terms that it isn't about you? We often refer to those here as not moments. The aha, I think I get it. That's what it's all about. When did you get your wound? When did you get your limp? And what is it? Maybe it was a wonderful experience that you had. I know when I first held each one of my children, and now my grandchildren, there is something there that tells me that I can never walk the same way again for the rest of my life. It's a delightful wound to have, to know that you've been changed forever. Maybe it was a traumatic wound that you received. Maybe it was a loss, a refusal, an alienation from something that was precious to you that you will never get back, that made you shift your center of gravity so that the world will forever be different as well. That wounding told you to stop trying to fill God's shoes. And that it's okay to walk, to limp in your own shoes. To do that is your fullness, even though it feels like something that might hurt. And that wrestling match, when you win it, or when you try to avoid it altogether, that is your emptiness. So let me leave you then with this idea. You have this wound or this limp, and this limp that you hold, that and that holds you and others and God in relationship, it will hold you better than any religion ever can. So hate it or love it, this wound that you have, doesn't matter which your relationship with it is, use it. And that limp is welcome here. That limp, in fact, that each of us brings here is the only thing we actually have. It is our victory. It is our strength. So I want to leave you with the words that I closed with the first week of Not One Stone, and then turn it on over to the band here. Perhaps you remember them from the first week, and perhaps you'll hear them with new ears today. They come from the prophet Micah, and I think they speak to exactly what we were just saying. Yahweh, the Lord, I am who I am. Yahweh has told you, O mortal, what is good. And what does I am who I am require of you? But to be in right relationship, to love loving, and to walk, to limp humbly with your God.
Thanks for listening. We hope you take this conversation and keep it going. If we are adding value to your life, we appreciate your support of this work so we can engage more people in these conversations that matter for their real lives too. You can do that at fabricmpls.com/give. We'd also love to have you join us any Sunday morning at 10:30 at Field Community School in Minneapolis. That's at 4645 4th Avenue South. There are opportunities for kids of all ages to connect too. Learn more by searching Fabric Minneapolis.